Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. And my guest is someone who some people say is the most interesting, most engaging politician in North Carolina.
Are you talking about Jim Hunt?
No, I'm talking about Rufus Edmonds. And Rufus, welcome.
Thank you, D.G.
A lot of people know you. We knew you first, I guess, as the Deputy Chief Counsel for the Senate Watergate Committee. That's taking it back a long time. You came back and became Attorney General. Then you were the Democratic nominee for governor. Then you became Secretary of State. And you've been interested in politics all your life, but you've also been interested in many other things. And all of that is now part of a new book you wrote called That's Rufus.
That's Rufus, yes.
A memoir of Tario politics, Watergate, and life. And I've been waiting for this for a long time.
Yeah, you kept encouraging me to write a book, put it down on paper. I remember you said, put it down on paper.
Well,
and we did it finally after 2.5 years.
You were working on it all along. I didn't think you'd ever finish because you're into so many other things. The part of your book that I like maybe better than anything is your memoir growing up outside of Boone, North Carolina, as a country boy. You declare yourself to be a country boy, but you overlapped with the people in Boone and around Appalachian State, and you were cultured country boy.
Well, there were lines of demarcation. If you lived way out in the county, you didn't have much to do with Boone except going out there on a Saturday morning to shop at the local Belk department store or something like that, or to get some school supplies. But if you were on the demarcation level, which was about a mile out of Boone where we lived, you had the best of both worlds. We had a farm, and there were 5 boys and 1 girl, and we were like indentured servants to my father, who was a good, kind man, but stern, hard worker. And I remember myself driving through town on many occasions, pulling a tractor with a trailer on it. Now, I mean a farm tractor, not a tractor trailer, a farm tractor with a trailer behind it with a load of cabbage on it. And I'm going up there on October the 4th for a book signing and look down on the street and tell the people in Watauga Historical Society that this is where I used to drive the tractor with a load of cabbage. And then you had good interaction between the people of Boone. I remember one of my favorite times was when I went and visit Mr. and Mrs. Robert Rivers. He was the editor of the Watauga Democrat.
Did he have a daughter?
He had a daughter, too, and her name was Rachel. And Rachel was a horse lady. She, at an early age, would ride down the streets of Boone on her little pony. And it would sometimes poop in the street, and people just said, well, that's just Rachel. She's just riding her pony down through there.
Well, you try to pull yourself off as a country boy, but thanks to Rachel Rivers, this country boy put on a tuxedo and went to the North Carolina State, whatever it is, ball, the debutante ball.
The debutante ball,
yeah,
the fancy debutante ball.
How do you pull yourself?
You know, I don't remember how in the world I ever got up the money to do that, or I don't remember discussing it with my mother and father. But Rachel had to, if you're a very gracious debutante, you have 2 accolades. And so the other man, Frank Payne, and I were chosen, and I kept thinking, well, why she chosen me? I've never had a tuxedo on in my life. I never had. I was in high school. And she chose me, and somehow I saved up enough cabbage money to go rent a tuxedo somewhere and get myself down to Raleigh for almost a week of this whirlwind of festivities that debutantes do. And I sure had to do a lot of acclimating, I'm telling you what, because I remembered how my mother said, now, this is how you use your fork and your spoon. Got a little tutorial on don't slap over at the table. Don't sing at the table. Don't let food drip out of the corners of your mouth. And be sure to have a napkin handy in the event you do drip something on your clothes. Don't scrub it off. Dab it off. And so we went through a week of this stuff, and then the final night came. And they got out there in this big cartwheel-like thing where the father goes out and he presents the daughter. and the rest of us to stand on the side and look dumb. But that was my debutante refresher course, and I can see the whole thing right now. It was done at Memorial Auditorium, we called it then. And I was a fancy dude, but don't have one single picture of that. I don't know why. I guess there's a
picture in your book of you and Rachel, maybe at a prom or something.
It was
like that.
The junior-senior prom.
But you looked pretty sophisticated.
You
looked like a country.
I had a white sport coat and a pink carnation.
But this is, for me, one of the times where your country boy image can be transformed almost immediately into a comfort level with whoever you happen to be with. And if it's the wealthy or the prominent political figures or the editor of the Watauga Democrat, you can adapt to that environment.
It's called paying attention to people and being kind. That was always my motto, be kind. And that translates out into you can be kind in any environment you're in. And that's what I've tried to talk about in that book all the way through. You never go wrong with being kind, and you learn a lot when you're kind. And my mother used to say, if you're talking, you're not listening. And she was right about that. And yes, I've in all my years, I've traveled to the four corners of the earth, on missions with the U.S. Senate, on times as Attorney General, times as Secretary of State. I've been in all the continents we have. And I don't think I ever met a total stranger, even though I didn't know a word they were saying. If you just listen to them, you can see from the inflection on their face that they're interested or not interested. And it's been a good education. And the country boy stuff came deep from the heart, but it was just part of my persona. No put on about it at all. I still love the idea that we were centered around the church. When you grew up, you had the school and the church, and that's how you were centered. Nothing else mattered because that's how you were centered. And ours was a little country church where they still shouted, where the Reverend Victor Trivet preached hellfire and damnation, and did a good job of scaring the hell out of everybody in sight.
He had an altar call every Sunday. Did you ever take advantage of
it? I never did. I found a way to weasel out of that every single time. But we had a lot of folks that he had this staration of different calls. You first to be saved. Now, that was the highest calling of all. Mm-hmm. If you could get if you could get a convert to come up and be saved, that was the highest honor you could get as a country preacher for the Reverend Victor Trivet. Then the next degree was had backslidden. Now, that was one where the backslider was the person.
You've been saved, but you
sort of let things go, and you needed to renew your devotion to Christ, and that was the second level. And the third level, which would encompass everybody, which he would always be able to get somebody in the end to renew their life, always.
You talked with such knowledge and enthusiasm, a little bit of skepticism, but I said, Rufus, I bet, thought about whether or not he could do as well in the pulpit as Reverend Trivet. And did you ever consider that?
I have been known to go out in the wild and preach a little bit just for the heck of it. I really have. I've been on a stump and preached a little bit because...
To people or just out there?
Just out there with the elements and the animals. I must say that I did develop a pretty good chant. And
you want to share that with us?
No, I do not want to do that because I'm still scared to death of blasphemy, that I might be stricken by lightning before I leave, and I'm afraid to do that. But I could preach a good sermon, and I knew my Bible well because I grew up on my grandmother's knee, Grandma Nan, reading Bible stories, and we had what we called Bible drills back in those days in the mid 20th century. A group of kids stood up before the congregation. Somebody would shout out John 3:16, and whoever got to it first and started reading it won. So you had to be agile. You had to be quick. It was like a Bible game show. It was called Bible drill. And you had to learn your Bible to do that, because you had to know where Second Peter was and where Second Corinthians, not Corinthians 2. I had to say that. Not Corinthians 2, but Second Corinthians.
You say that with all appreciation for the person who said that. At least he was engaged with the Bible for that moment. It was just numbers that he got wrong.
Just got the numbers wrong. Yeah.
Listen, those of you joined us late, you know who I'm talking to, because Rufus Edmondson talks in a distinctive combination, mountain boy and sophisticated political office holder voice, and we're so happy to have him. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Rufus Edmondson. Rufus Edmondson is one of the great heroes of North Carolina politics. And he also is an author. He's written a book called That's Rufus, A Memoir of Tar Heel Politics, Watergate, and Public Life. Rufus, I'd love to talk, or have you talk, more about your growing up in Boone. But you left Boone to come to the University of North Carolina.
I sure did.
It's Chapel Hill, and those folks...
I didn't intend to come first, though, to Chapel Hill.
What's the story?
I always had my heart set on going to NC State and majoring in something to do with animals, like animal husbandry.
Why?
And perhaps because I'd grown up with animals all my life. I'd attended the stock sales market out in my neighborhood, where they sold cattle and goats and horses every Tuesday in the summertime. And I was just determined that I was going to be a county agent at least, and maybe a veterinarian if I could ever pass chemistry. And then one of my dear antagonist friends, the local dentist, one time said, would you be interested in trying out for the Moorhead Scholarship? Well, you could have said to me, are you interested in going to the moon? And it wouldn't have made any difference, because I'd never heard of the Moorhead Scholarship or anything akin to that. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, it's a scholarship they give at Chapel Hill. And if you win it, you get 4 years all paid for everything. I mean, everything. I said, what harm can it be? So we had the interviews up at the Daniel Boone Hotel in Boone that I had never been in the hotel except to haul away garbage with my father to feed to the hogs. And that's another time when I had to really put the airs on, because now my mama was really, really concerned about my manners on that, and she gave me all the drill about how to behave myself and sit up straight and not slobber, but to answer the questions the right way and to look at people. So we did the interviews, and lo and behold, I won the county. And then I went on to the next level and won the district and was sent to the final thing to interview for the Moorhead Scholarship, and I remember a man named Mr. Roy Armstrong at Chapel Hill, who was the head of that, who called me a country boy. He said, here's this country boy from Boone. And a strange story is that I really wasn't qualified to enter the university because I had not taken a foreign language. And had no idea about that.
You were in the Moorhead competition, but you were ineligible to enroll.
Yeah, and did not know that at the time. We didn't have anything like a counselor at Appalachian High School. There was nobody telling you how you got to have this to get into school or a foreign language. And so I decided that, well, now I've seen Chapel Hill. I'm going to come to Chapel Hill one way or another. And I begged off the summer tobacco farming and cabbage farming from my daddy and said, I need to go to Chapel Hill for a summer. And came down here and took Latin.
Well,
as my foreign language.
As your foreign language, my guy.
Absolutely, took Latin. And Latin turned out to be very helpful to me in my later years as an attorney and attempting to be a wordsmith. It's amazing. Well, that's what brought me to Carolina. And all my dreams of going to NC State, which is a wonderful little thing.
Excuse me for interrupting. I should do this, but there's a piece of that story that I got confused about, and one of them was that they had wanted you to have calculus.
They wanted me to have calculus. And strangely enough, you don't need to be confused about it. You could substitute Latin.
For calculus.
For calculus.
So and you get the foreign language.
I got the foreign language and the calculus, and took a Spanish course while I was at it during the summer. Well, and the Providence smiled on me with that Latin in the place of calculus, because I never would have made it. I'm not good with numbers.
Well, you know, I went to a country high school, and
You have similar notions.
They did teach trigonometry, but they didn't teach calculus in the high school when I was there. So there would have been no way I could have gotten that. And so I said, "Well, golly, Appalachian High School, they're up there beside Appalachian State, and so they are higher. They've got higher abilities or better, more diverse curriculum."
Anyway, well, you didn't do bad yourself going to Davidson, my friend. You're very modest about your background and what you've achieved in life. You should let me interview sometime.
No, that would be good, but I've got much to be modest about. So I want to remember, if you will, some of the professors at Carolina. Most of them are gone now. But I think you mentioned Dr. Boyd.
Dr. Bernard Boyd, what a saint.
Tell us about Dr. Boyd.
Well, every college has what we call the CRIP courses. You want to get some good grading. And one of them was supposed to be religious literature. And I said, "Well, that looks like a good one to me. I'll take that." And somebody said it was a CRIP course. Well, I got in there, and I was so thrilled with it, with Dr. Boyd. He walked into the classroom every class, and he would say, "Everything makes a difference." I never forgot that. He never ended a class without saying it, and never began a class without saying it. And he was so correct. And rather than being a CRIP course, it became one of the hardest courses. I wrote a little paper in there called The tributes of the trials and tributes of Job, and then did a little paper on Micah, which he gave me an A on, and I couldn't get enough of Dr. Boyd. And later, when I was Attorney General, I had the great pleasure of helping, when he was passed away, I had the great pleasure of helping his wife, Bunny, as he called her, Bunny, solve a little problem with her retirement. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to have done.
I'm so glad.
I remember Dr. Howell.
Tell us about Dr. Howell.
Dr. Howell was...
We got Howell Hall, don't we?
We have Howell Hall. I don't know whether it's... I don't believe it's named after Howell.
Okay.
It could be.
Well, tell us about your Dr. Howell.
My Dr. Howell was a bespectacled older man in about his 70s. And he would love for you to memorize passages. And that would seem like that's sort of arcane today for people memorizing passages out of whole works. And I remember one time I virtually memorized the entire poem Thanatopsis. Now, that is a hard one. I couldn't begin to recite that again today. And he would get you to get up and recite it, parts of it. And there was more mumbling and babbling and speaking of tongues than you've ever heard in your life. But he ended up giving me a B plus, and those are the days when you could send fill out a postcard and address it to yourself and get your grade. Had you ever heard of that?
Not until I read your book.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
You got your grades on a postcard if you wanted to. Well, never mind everybody.
That would keep it from being posted.
Yeah,
You would get your grade, but you wouldn't have to.
You hadn't posted and let everybody else read it. But of course, if it came to your dorm room, everybody in the world read it anyway.
Well,
Dr. Howell, and we had the chief of police was a friend of mine, Bo. You might remember his name. My roommate and I got in a little trouble one night, and we were a little bit into some of the what I call back home the slop. My roommate was named Danny Edwards, but he was nicknamed Remus. It was Rufus and Remus, living in 403A.
And he was your roommate, and people put you all together, and you're all real buddies, not just
real buddies, yeah.
But and you got in a little trouble.
They nicknamed him Remus. And we lived in 403 Avery Dorm, and we got in a little bit of trouble. And Bowman, and it wasn't Bowman, I'm going to think of the name, this tough Irish Yankee chief of police that everybody knew at that time back in the the 60s, took us in one night to the Chapel Hill Jail and said, "This is where you boys are going to go if you don't settle down." And he clanged the door. He slammed the door and said, "You want to go in there? You boys better stop cutting up," because we were ripping around town in my 54 Chevrolet in a foolish manner, as kids will do at times. And we had just gotten in a fight over underneath the 403 Avery dorm, and there were people hanging out the windows betting on us. He was, in my memory, firmly ensconced. I had lots of wonderful memories of the what's the beautiful arboretum there? Coker Arboretum. I loved that place. From my family background of being on the farm and loving flower gardening with my mother, I'd walk through there sometimes and snitch a whole bunch of blooms and take them back to to the dorm room. And my roommate said, "What are you, a sissy or something like that?" And I said, "Well, no, I just love flowers. And you want to fight about it? If you'd like to have a little fight about it, then we'll fight about flowers if you want to." And so he shut up about that for a while, because I only whooped him twice. And the dean of men, I'm trying to think of his name, he was well known to me too. He's still living. Ray, well, Ray, God bless you. I know you, and you're still alive, and you're a good man. So he was familiar with Edmiston and Edwards.
Well, before we need to take a break, but before we do, you mentioned in your introductions that Ray Dawson had been a lot to you.
I was getting to that next. The dear, wonderful Ray Dawson, who was passed away. He really got me involved in politics a lot by telling me. I remember his lectures about pressure groups. Well, you know, it's funny in life. I used to, as Secretary of State, I used to regulate the pressure groups. I am a pressure grouper right now. I'm a lobbyist, and I understand all about that, and I can hear his lectures right now.
Wow.
And when Ray was acting on behalf of the administration, I would allow them to use my conference room in the second floor of the building next to the legislature.
But I was a lobbyist. I was a beneficiary of that wonderful asset that you gave us when I was
you were one of the best
with my mentor
Macmillan,
Mr. Mac and Mr. Robertson were wonderful people, and they really loved you, and I think it was reciprocated, because we pretty much took over your office sometimes.
Yes, and I was glad to furnish that.
Well, listen, we do need to take a break. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Rufus Edmiston. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Barton. I'm visiting with Rufus Edmiston. And we've been talking about his growing-up years, his time at Carolina. But one of the signal events in your life, Rufus, maybe the signal event, was your service working for Senator Sam Ervin on what we call the Watergate Committee.
No question about it.
And one of the kind of things, if you're going to have a movie, you'd frame the movie of this young aide who's going to take the subpoena to the
right.
White House. Will you tell us that? How did that happen? Tell us the state. You know, most people don't have in their memories.
No, over half of the population's never heard of Watergate. And Watergate was a scandal where President Nixon and his cohorts plotted, schemed, and conspired to do things to overthrow the norms of government in America, and by snooping on people, wiretapping people, threatening to take reprisals against people if they didn't support them politically. And the Watergate Committee was formed after there was a break-in 1972 On June the 5th, 1972, there was a break-in at this little, at this place called Watergate, which was a fancy condominium in Washington, where the Democratic National Committee was housed. And this break-in seemed to be, quote, a routine third-rate burglary, as Nixon's press secretary one time said. Alas, it was much more than a routine break-in. As the Watergate Committee was formed because Senator Mike Mansfield said, we've got to get to the bottom of this, because after the break-in, over and over again, references were made to somebody higher up hiring these people. Well, you think about burglars coming out there with coats and ties on and suits. That was not like the normal burglary. And they immediately started, and the White House started to cover it up, because in the beginning, it was orchestrated by the White House. The break, not by Nixon himself, but it was orchestrated by the White House. And we got on down to the point where the Irvin Committee was appointed, with Senator Irvin the chair and Senator Howard Baker as the vice chair. And there never could have been a better pair put together than Irvin and Baker, because they agreed to never disagree on anything, and they didn't. That's why it worked. It's the only hearing I know of in my career that ever really worked, and there's not been one since. Well, finally, at a hearing where our friend Gene Boyce, who's a North Carolina lawyer, was doing the prep work for a man named Alexander Butterfield, who was...
We're getting him ready to testify.
We're just prepping him. You don't prep him. I'm just saying that a good lawyer never puts somebody on the stand unless you know what they're going to say.
What was Butterfield's
job? Butterfield's job was a logistics guy. He was supposed to know who was here and who was there, and sort of an aide to President Nixon.
It was a low-level guy,
and so none of us were in the room that day. And Gene Boyce, with his ingenuity, had pieced together some testimony from John Dean, where John Dean one time, when he testified before the Watergate Committee, said, I felt like I was being taped. And Gene Boyce and his assistants asked Butterfield if there was a taping system in the White House.
This is in the preliminary hearings,
and it was a bombshell. Though I remember Gene came to me. Senator Irvin and I were at a party out at Senator Herman Talmadge's home, and said, my God, you won't believe this, that there's a taping system in the White House. And I remember Senator Irvin said, don't tell a soul, and especially don't tell Lowell Weicker, who was the senator from Connecticut.
Was Weicker
he was a big leaker. Big leaker. Everybody on the Watergate Committee leaked, and a little bit here and there.
Excuse me for interrupting. I want to pin you to the wall. And this is my only chance to do it. And the question is, were you a leaker?
There are times when I leaked something when I thought it was absolutely necessary for...
Always in the service of
justice.
Irvin,
yeah,
justice.
In the service of Senator Irvin and justice. But my main thing was to try to plug a lot of them, but I didn't go to the extent that the White House plumbers did.
But excuse me for... I mean, this is not fair, because I really am trying to ambush you on this. But the rationale is... We don't leak but if there is an opportunity to get a good version of the facts, or an important version of the facts, out there, so it helps the investigation, or it helps Senator Irvin, you can rationalize.
Yeah, it's a rationalization, and you just hope you were right. Mm-hmm. And anybody that says they never leaked a drop here and there is fooling themselves, or sort of fibbing, because everybody leaked a little bit except Senator Irvin. He didn't even know he didn't know what the word meant. He thought it'd be a leaky faucet.
Well, I interrupted you, and you said that Senator Weicker was you didn't want him to know, but.
He was considered by the committee to be the biggest leaker of all, and he's a fine gentleman who's still alive, but he was considered number one leaker of the committee.
So, but you guys, you've got, this is going to be a long story, we might have to take a break, but you guys are ready to figure out a way to announce to the public.
John Dean had just testified for almost four days straight in his less than stellar way. He was a brilliant guy, but just so boring, I can't believe it. John Dean was, although he's a buddy of mine, and we've appeared on panels before. His boring testimony for 3.5 days said that there was a cancer arising on the presidency, and told that Nixon had knowledge of the, not of the break-in, but of the cover-up, was right in the middle of it. Well, the White House denied that vigorously. They said that he was a very evil person, that he knew nothing but a lie, that Dean was just a liar all the way around. And there we would have, Dean said, and then a couple days after Dean has testified, here is this revelation executive session, we call it, where the question was asked of Butterfield, is there a taping system in the White House? And he said, yes, there is. And it took a while to drag it out of him, according to Gene. I wasn't in the room. And then the question was, if that's the case, there is a taping system, how do you get them? And we were all up in Irvin's office one day, 46 years ago, this past January, past June the 23rd, that was 46 years ago we were in that office, and Senator Irvin said to me, Rufus, go get the president on the telephone. We want to ask him if he'll voluntarily turn over the tapes. Well, that was sort of like, go out and get a loaf of bread while you're at it. And so I went to this ante room, and I had the right number to dial of that, as he would say, I dialed up the number of Rosemary Wood. And this is a little side story. I said, Ms. Wood, this is Rufus Edmiston, Deputy Chief Counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee. Senator Irvin and Senator Baker would like to speak to the president. And she says, well, hold on, I'll be back. Well, recall that all during this time, the White House and President Nixon in particular had been saying, the Watergate Committee is out to get me. Well, while I'm waiting on Ms. Wood to come back on the phone, this voice comes on, Senator Irvin, this is Richard Nixon. I'm so astounded, I said, hold on, Mr. President, Senator Irvin wants to get you. So I said, no, sir, on the phone. I'm sorry, on the phone. And after I composed myself and went in there and told the senator that the president was on the phone, because I didn't even know how to put that new dial thing on hold at that time, the senator got on there, and I could tell from the one side of the conversation that it was not going well with the senator, because his eyebrows were going like windshield wipers in high gear. And he said, well, you have no right, Mr. President, to withhold from American people evidence of wrongdoing. And we knew it was going badly. And then after the phone conversation ended, Senator Baker said, well, it looks like we'll have to subpoena these things. And Irvin said, well, that's right. And they took a preliminary vote right there on the spot. It was unanimous to subpoena the president. And then somebody had to figure out how, well, you issue a subpoena. What are the fundamentals of that? It had never been done before. Well, I figured out a way, because I wanted to deliver that subpoena myself. And I took executive privilege, since I was sort of the COO of the committee, to say, I'll take that subpoena down there. And it was the hottest afternoon in the world, E.G. It was like one of these Chapel Hill, Raleigh days in the middle of July. It was just, it was choking. It was so hot. And we slowly drove down. I was in the back of a police car, and my mother said one time, well, you're in there for a good reason this time. And the black of the police car going down Pennsylvania Avenue, and it must have been 200 reporters following us. On that July the 23rd, 46 years ago, and I got to the White House, and then we had made arrangements before that they would meet us at the Executive Office Building, which is next door to the White House. And it was a man named Mr. Leonard Garment was the White House counsel at the moment, and another man named Professor. He wrote a book that I used in law school, and I thought, my goodness, how strange this is. But I got up and read the subpoena like I was supposed to, according to Senate Resolution 32, I hereby serve you, subpoena, did all my things. And then I did a little devilish thing. I had in my back pocket one of those little blue constitutions that Irvin carried around all the time. And I whipped into my back pocket and I took one out and I said, I think you could use one of these down here too.
Oh my gosh.
So I put the Constitution on Leonard Garment and Professor Charles Allen Wright right there on the spot. And that was the first time in history that a committee of the Congress had ever served a subpoena on a sitting president.
Well, Rufus, we need to take a break, but that story rings with, there's a resonance with where we are today in our situation with our current president.
So we have another Watergate today.
I appreciate your sharing that story. Rufus Evanson, I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I've been visiting with Rufus Edmondson, and we've just, Rufus, thank you for the inside look at back at Watergate, and we couldn't help but think when you talked about serving the subpoena on President Nixon about what's going on today with our current president. But your book's so full of wonderful stories about the mountains, about your life, about the ups and downs of your life. You know, I saw you ran for governor and got a very, disappointing result, and you sprang back and into life all the great things that you learned as a country boy. You've enjoyed, and you've been a great example to all of us. What, before we close up, what words of wisdom do you have for us?
Well, I think that every experience, you better learn from it, and I found too, DG, that people notice you and pay more attention to you when you've been down in the valley of despair. They want to know how you come out of there. They want to know if you've got the guts to come out of the valley of despair and climb back up in the mountain. And where the, as Irvin used to say, where the fresh, cool water comes from the well on the top of the mountain. And I've tried to, throughout the book, which is widely available now in different stores and Flyleaf and Chapel Hill and Barnes and Noble, to say that there are a few simple things in life that I've tried to live by. And the number one is have empathy for people, other people. That doesn't mean giving some money to the Red Cross. That means really putting yourself into somebody else's shoes. Mm. And number two is never forget to thank those who helped you get where you are. And once you've done that, thank them again. Mm. And then the third principle I've tried to live from is avoid hubris. I've had bouts of hubris in my life, and they're nothing but evil. Hubris will ruin people.
In your great book, you write about that.
Yes.
Love that you wrote about that.
And I went to them.
Now, a lot of people, I mean, you went to Chapel Hill, so you know what hubris means.
But I know exactly what it means. You think that nobody sees what you're doing and that you're bigger than life, and it ruins so many good people. Then you got to have some sort of spirituality. I'm not designating which kind, how, who. What you do, to cap it off, you have to have some sort of spirituality and a sense of forgiveness, because the only way you never let those have any power over you is to let it all go. Bill Clinton wrote me a letter one time in handwritten form where he said, no matter how badly you were hurt and how they tried to do you evil for whatever reason, you have to let it go. It's the only way those who hurt you no longer have any power over you. And I've tried to live that kind of life, and it's been a good life, and I have contributed so much of that to my dear sweet wife, who's the brilliant one in the family, Linda Harris Edmiston, who has a beautiful picture in the book, and you ought to buy the book just to look at her picture.
Well, Rufus, your lovely wife has been sitting with us, and she is. And I, as you point out in the book and you point out today, she's been an important part of your balance through life and the positive attitude that you've always shown, which is inspirational to the rest of us. So I want to thank both of y'all for coming over to Chapel Hill and for your book, That's Rufus, and it's available for sale. A lot of the things that we couldn't talk about today are covered in that.
All proceeds go to the Super Kids Fund, which is fund that I a program I've had for 32 years where kids overcome adversity, and we help them go to college. All the proceeds go to that.
That's one more good reason to buy the book. Thanks again for coming and sharing your story with us.
My pleasure.
Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.